There was something kind of fun on social media around Christmas time as I was watching listeners get their Brooklinen sheets for Christmas. So I'm glad you guys listened to us. I have become a sheet snob since getting Brooklinen sheets. And before this, I had no idea why someone would be a sheet snob. You're going to spend a third of your life in your sheets, and you might as well make it count. Switch away from those bed-in-a-bag sets from years ago that are rough and scratchy. Get sleeping better with better sheets. With Brooklinen.com, you can get high-quality sheets and bedding you deserve without the luxury retail prices. They cut out the unnecessary markups, the retail licensing fees, the manufacturing waste, all those costs that get passed on to the consumer. And they can offer these high-end designs and exceptional savings across their entire collection. You have to try these sheets. I love my Brooklinen sheets. Try these sheets, and I know you'll love them too. Brooklinen.com has an exclusive offer for our listeners. Get $20 off and free shipping when you use promo code SITE at Brooklinen.com. In fact, Brooklinen is so confident that you'll love your new sheets that they offer a risk-free 60-night satisfaction guarantee and a lifetime warranty on all of their sheets and comforters. There's no reason not to give these sheets a try. The only way to get that $20 off and free shipping is to use promo code SITE at Brooklinen.com. That's Brooklinen.com, promo code SITE. Brooklinen, these are the best sheets ever.
Hello there, I am Ali, this is Insight, and there is Charlie. How are you?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm doing well. This is the first time we're recording together for 2018, which is kind of cool. This week we're talking about a multiple abduction, two sisters who went missing in Maryland in 1975 and are now considered murdered after last year. A man named Lloyd Lee Welch was sentenced for abducting and murdering the girls. This week, we're talking about the disappearance of Catherine and Sheila Lyon, the Lyon sisters. And helping us out on the episode this week is our researcher, Jessica. So thank you, Jessica. And before we start this week's episode, this week we do talk about a case involving young children and crimes against young children that are quite graphic. Listener discretion is advised. On the morning of Tuesday, March 25, 1975, Catherine Mary Lyon, who was 10 years old at the time, and her older sister, 12-year-old Sheila Mary Lyon, they were on spring break from school. Now, I didn't repeat myself incorrectly. Both had the middle name of Mary, and they were named after their mother. They lived in Kensington, Maryland. Now, Kensington is a suburb of Washington, D.C., and it's filled with families and lots of kids running around. It was a very family-friendly area. Washington in March was truly warming up, and this day was an example of this. On March 25th, Catherine, who was known by Kate, she was at home with Sheila, their two brothers, 14-year-old Jay and 9-year-old Joe, and their parents. Their father, John Lyon, was a popular radio personality on the local radio station, WMAL. And at the time, this station was the number one radio station in Washington. This station was also owned by the same person that owned the Washington Star newspaper, and that will come up again later. On this Tuesday, John was on air late the night before, so he was asleep catching up on the sleep he missed the night before. The girl's mother, Mary Lyon, was getting ready to leave to play with her bowling league, and the kids, they were still deciding what to do for the day.
This Tuesday was just a normal day, although the kids weren't in school owing to it being spring break. The family had eaten breakfast and cleaned their dishes, and around 11:15 a.m. the phone rang. It was Kate's best friend, Melanie Gannis. She was calling to see if Kate could come and play, and Kate told Melanie that the girls weren't supposed to play at their house because their father needed to sleep, so she and her sister were going to walk over to the Wheaton Plaza Mall. Wheaton Plaza Mall was a large outdoor shopping mall with lots of stores and restaurants, and it was about half a mile or 0.8 kilometers from the Lyon home. It was a hangout for local kids and teens, like malls tend to be. The sisters liked to go there to buy candy and browse in the stores. On this day, the girls had already planned to go there to look at the Easter decorations. Kate did ask Melanie if she wanted to join them, but Melanie said no, she wasn't allowed to go to the mall without an adult. So Kate and Melanie instead made plans for later that afternoon for around 3 p.m., and she would call her back then. Kate and Sheila went up to their room to get ready to go to the mall, and their room was every girl their age's dream room. It was bright, and it was sunny, it had yellow walls, it was filled with stuffed animals. Kate changed into Wrangler jeans, a gold turtleneck, a red jacket, and brown shoes. Sheila changed into tan jeans and a navy blue sweatshirt. When the girls were ready to go, their mother told them, go ahead and take some money and stop at the Orange Bowl restaurant in the mall before they came home to just grab a slice of pizza. So the girls each took about $2 of their own money, which would be plenty because a slice of pizza back then was 45 cents. Mary Lyon reminded the girls to be back around 3, and they set off walking at around 11:30.
The girls walked out the front door, out of the gate from their yard onto Jennings Road, and then onto a wooden path that cut from Jennings Road to the more commercial area where the mall was located. Now, the walk should have taken no more than 15 minutes. That day, the mall was very busy. The Orange Bowl restaurant was packed, and they ended up selling something like 2,500 slices of pizza that day. At least six people recall seeing the girls at Wheaton Plaza Mall that afternoon. Sarah Bioska was a clerk at the Beckett's Leather Store, and she says the girls stopped into the store to look at a wallet around 11:45. She knew the girls and she recognised them immediately, so I'd say this was when they first got to the mall. Next was Brian Maccabee. He was a worker at Up Against the Wall, which was a store selling trendy, youth-orientated clothes and accessories. He saw the girls in his store as well, just after the Becker's sighting. And then the girls' older brother, Jay, says he saw Kate and Sheila at about 1 o'clock near the Easter display, and another 13-year-old boy also saw the girls talking to the Easter Bunny. Finally, a different 13-year-old boy, who is only known by the name Jimmy, and this is an alias because his mother was worried about putting her son in potential danger. But he says that he saw the girls talking to a middle-aged man carrying a briefcase who appeared to be talking to the girls with a microphone and a tape recorder. At the time, Jimmy and his friend had joked about going over to the man and asking him to interview them so they could be on TV. But then Jimmy and his friend overheard the man talking to the girls, and it made them both a little uneasy, although Jimmy couldn't explain why he felt that way. This man was asking the girls if they were involved in sports. Jimmy stated that the girls and the men walked away from each other in separate directions. He told police that he never saw the man before or since then.
Now, there was another report by a 12-year-old boy who knew the girls from school, David Reed. He says he saw Kate and Sheila walking away from their home and toward the mall, but this sighting was at 7:30 p.m., which is outside of the known timeline, and there's no one else who can confirm this sighting of the girls. This last sighting was contradicted by a sighting that didn't come into police until 2 weeks after the disappearance. A boy who knew the girls from swimming made a statement to the police that he remembered seeing the girls walking towards their home around 2:30 p.m. His reasoning for waiting 2 weeks before coming forward was because of the 7:30 sighting, and he thought maybe he was confused and what he actually saw or misremembered what he saw. Now, this fits much better with the known timeline and of knowing the girls were supposed to be home by 3, and the police accept this statement as being accurate. Two other witnesses who significantly did not see Sheila or Kate that day were Melanie, Kate's friend, who you remember Kate was going to call at 3, and Mrs. Kuster, who Kate had promised to visit that afternoon so that she could see her new baby. The fact that Kate didn't call or visit either of these two is a pretty clear indication that she never made it home that day.
I mean, I guess it's possible that they did go home for a short period of time and Kate just didn't call them, but from what I can tell, they sound like pretty reliable kids. I think that Kate would have at least called the friend that was expecting the call.
Yeah, I agree.
John Lyon met his wife outside her bowling league after the game. They went to a bookstore and the bank together and got back home around 3:30. John took another nap and Mary worked in the yard. The boys, Jay and Joe, came home, but not with the girls. Now, Mary wasn't too worried. She just assumed that they ran into friends at the mall, or maybe they went to see a movie and just lost track of time. By dinner time, though, and we're talking at 6:30 in the evening here, this is where Mary is getting annoyed that the girls weren't back. So the family, they go ahead and eat dinner without the girls. But by the time dinner finished and was cleaned up, around 7 o'clock, the girls still weren't home and alarm bells start going off for John and Mary. They drive to the mall to see if the girls might have been walking home, but when they didn't find them, Mary starts calling around to the girls' friends' houses and John goes back to the mall to search for them. By the time John got back home again, it's 8 p.m, it's dark. The Lyons then call the police and the search begins. The theory that Kate and Sheila might have run away from home was dismissed very quickly. Everyone considered the family to be happy and just your average middle-class family. The girls were busy, they had their after-school activities, lots of friends, and seemed well-adjusted. Sheila was the quiet one. She was an honours student at her junior high school, and she was into art and cooking and wanted to be a cheerleader. Kate was the more outgoing sister. She was into gardening, volleyball and running. Also, Sheila and Kate were 12 and 10. They were younger than most kids who leave home by choice. Most runaways, statistically, are between 14 and 17 years old. As I said, they had lots of friends and they were well liked by neighbours and the community, who often saw all the Lyon kids playing outdoors. Their neighbourhood was considered a safe one. We're talking about 1975 here. Kids walked and biked places without parental supervision all the time. But if they hadn't run away, then where were they?
Investigators looking for Kate and Sheila focused very quickly on the sighting of the man with the microphone and tape recorder and the brown briefcase. And the witness who had reported seeing the girls with the man worked with the police sketch artist to come up with a likeness. It showed a Caucasian, well-dressed, middle-aged man, probably 50s, with thick lips, a narrow nose, and black and gray hair. A sketch of Tape Recorder Man, as he became known, was widely circulated. Many people reported having seen this man at various other malls and shopping centers throughout the area. Police received about 15 new leads from people who thought they had seen a man who resembled the sketch and fit the description a few days before the girls went missing at two shopping centers in the neighboring Prince George's County. One of these leads was a sales girl at the mall. She was interviewed by the police and said a man fitting the description had approached her on the same day the girls went missing. He had a microphone and a tape recorder. He asked her to read a message for his answering machine. He would say something like, "Gee, you have a nice voice. Would you read an answering machine message for me?" He handed her an index card and asked her to read from that, but she refused. It is kind of a weird request, and he left. On March 29th, the Washington Post published the sketch along with an article about the search and made note of a $7,000 reward, which was being offered for information about the girls. According to that same article, more than 50 Montgomery County police officers combed the brush surrounding the mall area and railroad tracks in Kensington. Police mailed 5,000 posters with the girls' pictures to police departments and businesses throughout Maryland, Delaware, Virginia, D.C., really in that just a fair radius from where they went missing. The search included scuba diving into a local pond, a door-to-door search of neighborhood homes, which we've seen in similar cases before, and repeated searches of the wooded areas surrounding the shopping plaza. There was not a sign of the girls anywhere.
Before we continue, a word from one of our sponsors this week, ZipRecruiter. A fresh new year has begun, and if you're setting new goals for your business, it's extremely difficult to reach them without the right people on your team. And ZipRecruiter has transformed how you go about finding them. ZipRecruiter posts your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards with just one click. Then ZipRecruiter actively looks for the most qualified candidates and invites them to apply. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other hiring sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on the right candidates finding you. It finds them. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes and industries to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ziprecruiter.com/site. That's ziprecruiter.com/site. One more time to try it for free. Go to ziprecruiter.com/site. In the days and weeks that followed, a few attempts at extortion were made by individuals demanding ransom payments. While most of these attempts were quickly considered to be crank calls, one was taken more seriously. And this occurred on Friday, April 4, 1975, when a male called demanding that John Lyon place $10,000 in a restroom at the county courthouse in Annapolis. John and the Montgomery County Police left a briefcase as instructed, but no one came to get it. The man later called back and said that there were too many police in the area for him to get the money. When told he actually had to produce some evidence before he could get the ransom to be paid again, he said that he would call back later, but he never did. Now, this information about the ransom demand was not made public at the time. On Monday, April 7, 1975, at 7:30 in the morning, a witness in Manassas, Virginia, reported that he saw two young girls bound and gagged in the back of a beige 1968 Ford station wagon. The witness said the driver of the car resembled the man in the composite sketch. When the driver of the car saw that he was being followed and watched, he accelerated, ran a red light, and drove towards the interstate. It was reported that the vehicle had Maryland plates, possibly with the combination DMT and a 6. The witness couldn't see the last two numbers because the plate was bent. Investigators did a check of every possible combination. Those particular letters were issued in Cumberland, Hagerstown, and Baltimore in Maryland, but no further leads came from it. While this report seemed like the big break in the case at the time, it was later considered questionable by police. About a month later, there was a massive search in the woods just west of Wheaton Plaza by the National Guard, troops. There were helicopters, dog teams, and volunteers. All of this was heavily documented in the newspapers at the time. And although some clothing was found, it was determined pretty quickly that the clothing didn't belong to either of the girls. But the Lyon sisters wouldn't be the only children to go missing in this area. There was a number of children around the same age that went missing close to where the Lyon sisters lived and in the same time period.
The first of whom is Wendy Eaton, and she was 15 when on May 17, 1975, in Media, Pennsylvania, her family went to play golf at the country club. Wendy decided to stay home to sunbathe. When her family came home, she wasn't home, but her bathing suit was on her bed, so it looked like she had changed and left the house. She had spoken to a friend earlier and mentioned walking down to the store to pick up a gift for her brother. People saw her at an intersection by her house, and later during the search, dogs tracked her scent to that intersection and no further. So it's kind of odd. Maybe it's a coincidence, maybe it's just one of those quirks of an investigation, that people saw her at an intersection, but it appears she never made it past there, yet no one reports having seen her get into a car or anything. It was not believed by her family from the start that this was a runaway situation. Wendy had no history of running away. She had plans for a church choir rehearsal that night. She was very active in her church, and her faith may have played into this early theory that she may have gotten involved in a cult, but there really is no evidence of this.
It's interesting how they go straight to cult. I don't know where they got that from.
I'm wondering, I actually want to, I was kind of curious and I didn't get a chance to look it up, but I was wondering if there was some cult presence in 1975 Pennsylvania that would cause concern, because it is an interesting thing I wouldn't think of today, but they clearly thought it then. So it would be interesting to see what the cult situation in 1975 Pennsylvania was like. 5 weeks after Wendy went missing, on June 24th, another 15-year-old disappeared just about 20 miles away from Wendy. Edna Thorne was a recent junior high graduate from Philadelphia. Her brother-in-law had gifted her a pony, and she was boarding it at a relative's house. On the day she went missing, she had gone down to the stable to see the horse. Her younger sister was invited to go with her, but declined. This is one reason Edna probably wasn't a runaway. She invited someone to go with her. Edna made it to the stable, and she was seen leaving the stable, but she never made it home. Although Edna had been in foster care at some point, which points to a somewhat unstable family life, there was no indication she was planning to run away. She had a minor argument with her sister, but from what I've seen, it kind of sounds like normal sibling bickering. She left behind all her money and her cigarettes, and it's not believed she was dating anyone at the time. After she went missing, her older sister received disturbing phone calls from a man who claimed he knew what Edna was wearing when she disappeared and claimed that he buried her in a local park. Investigators did investigate this as a possible homicide, but there isn't a lot of information about the investigation available beyond that. And then just 2 weeks later, on July 8th, a 14-year-old girl named Tracy King went missing. She was a little farther away, about 2 hours by car, in Littlestown, Pennsylvania. Tracy was a resident at a home for children called the Hoffman Home, and it focused on treating kids with psychological or emotional issues. She did have a history of running away from the home, but she always returned a short time later, both of the times she ran away, and it hasn't been reported where she went these other times she ran away. There are some conflicting reports. I saw one say she disappeared with another girl from the home named Stephanie, but another said she was missing after a roller skating outing with the Hoffman Home and made no mention of another girl being missing. Even with the instability in her life, though, I think we need to point out that she wrote to her family regularly. In fact, she actually apologized that she didn't write to them more, but she wrote to them fairly regularly while she was at the Hoffman House. It wouldn't be like her to, first, stop contacting her family entirely, and second, to not return on her own after a few days. It's very possible she ran away, but as we know, runaways are very vulnerable. And we don't know what happened after she ran away. She may have come across the wrong person. She may have met with foul play. There were skeletal remains found in New York 13 years after she had gone missing, and they were thought to be Tracy's, but dental records would later show that this wasn't her, though foul play is still suspected, not just in Tracy's case, but in the other two as well.
And all of these cases are linked to the Lyon girls, but they've never been officially considered victims of the same killer by the police. We will link the Charlie Project pages for all three girls on our website and Facebook page if you'd like to read up more on Wendy, Edna and Tracy, because they are all devastating cases in their own right. In 1982, Montgomery County officers spent 3.5 hours digging quote-unquote test holes in the backyard of a house that wasn't far from when the Lyon sisters were last seen. The house belonged to Raymond Rudolph Molesky Sr. Molesky lived in Prince George's County in 1975. He shot his eldest son with a high-power rifle in the basement of their home. When his wife Dolores ran down the stairs into the basement to see what was going on, he shot her as well. This bullet would pass through her, through a wall, and into the mouth of their 7-year-old son Peter. Now, Peter would survive the shooting, and Molesky would turn himself in. A story about Montgomery County Police digging in the backyard of the Molesky home was in the Washington Post in April of 1982, but only briefly. At the time, nothing much came of it. The story told of police digging these test holes for about 3 hours in response to tips from inmates at the same prison Molesky was serving his sentence, but nothing was found. End of story? Not quite. In 2001, an anonymous tip came into the police, naming Molesky having told others prior to his 1978 murder conviction that he was in some way involved in the Lyons sisters' disappearance. Many elements of this tipster's story were checked out and they were found to be accurate. Molesky was contacted and he admitted in writing that he indeed did know who took Kate and Sheila. He wouldn't name anyone, but he did give a general description of the area where the girls were allegedly buried. In the letter, he would only give very general statements. He said he wanted to negotiate for a prison transfer before he would speak with investigators. Now, this transfer was never carried out, and Molesky never spoke about what he knew.
Then in the beginning of March 1987, Fred Howard Coffey Jr. was viewed as a possible suspect. In 1987, Coffey was serving 50 years for molesting 3 children in North Carolina. He was facing trial for the rape and murder of another little girl, 10-year-old Amanda Ray. Coffey was subsequently convicted of murder and sentenced to death, but while he was on death row, he appealed, and his case was sent back for resentencing in 1990 due to what really amounts as a paperwork error. Again, he was sentenced to death. And then another appeal in 1994 found that the state erroneously brought up his previous convictions of sexual molestation of the other 3 children into the sentencing phase. And this had to do with timing. The convictions occurred before the crime which he was charged with or something. I don't know. The full decision is available online if anyone is interested. It's much more than we're going to go into here. It's not terribly relevant. But this time, Coffey's sentence was commuted to life. He has been up for parole many times in recent years, but he keeps being denied. Now, we're not going to go into the details of Coffey's extensive history of heinous crimes against children, but to just give you some idea, he reportedly confessed to a psychologist that he molested as many as 100 children. He would use these gimmicks to lure children, like fishing poles, metal detectors, and possibly even disguises. And although he never admitted to killing anyone, he was suspected for other murders of children in the various areas he's lived in. Besides the Lyons sisters, he was also a person of interest in the July 1975 abduction and murder of 15-year-old Kathy Lynn Beatty, who was also from Montgomery County, Maryland, as well as the February 1981 abduction and murder of 5-year-old Neely Smith in Charlotte. As for his connection to the Lyons sisters, he was known to be in that area. Less than a week after the sisters' disappearance, he interviewed for a job close by. With all of these suspicions around him and the nature of the crimes he was convicted of, it's really no wonder why parole keeps being denied. Another man considered a suspect for some time was John Brennan Crutchley. He was convicted for the kidnapping and rape of a teenager, and he was called the vampire rapist because he drained the blood of his victim almost to the point of death while he repeatedly sexually assaulted her. She lost something like 40% of her blood when she was taken to the hospital after she escaped him. Her abduction and rape are the only charges he has faced, even though he's suspected of murdering more than 30 women. They just can't get enough evidence against him. Due to violating his parole and being convicted of a drug charge after his release from these charges, he is now serving a life sentence due to the 3 strikes law. The previous 2 strikes were in relation to the abduction and rape. And generally, speaking, I am against three strikes laws. This basically means your third felony is an automatic life sentence. I don't think a parole violation should count as a third strike, especially when it was a failed drug test and it was marijuana. That doesn't seem like something worthy of putting someone in prison for the rest of life over. However, I will never lose a moment's sleep over this case. He absolutely should have been in jail for the rest of his life. As for his connection to the Lyon sisters, it's circumstantial at best. During the mid-1970s, he lived in Fairfax, Virginia. However, he was extensively familiar with the Montgomery County area because his wife's family lived there. He's also been linked, like Coffey was, to the abduction and murder of Kathy Lynn Beatty. But again, these suspicions are based mostly on proximity. And in this case, it's been completely unproven he was anywhere near the scene. And so he wasn't considered a major suspect for very long.
Despite the intense search and the commitment of the police to find the missing girls, the police overlooked or maybe they just discounted something that would later turn out to be crucial. One of the girls' friends, who, like Jimmy before, was referred to by an alias, she was known by the name Darlene in contemporary news articles, but Darlene told the police that she saw Kate and Sheila at the mall being followed by a long-haired, acne-ridden man in his late teens or early 20s. He was white and he had a scar on one cheek. She said this man was following the girls around and staring at them so intently that she went up to him and made a smart remark along the lines of, "Take a picture, it'll last longer." The police sketch artist did a drawing of this man, but at the time they had their focus of the investigation on tape recorder man. And this second sketch and this possible suspect just slipped through the cracks and ended up languishing in the case file. Now, tape recorder man was never found and the case began to grow cold. It would remain open and unsolved for close to 40 years. Now, the impact that the disappearance of the Lyon sisters had on the community cannot be overstated. As I said earlier, this was a safe neighbourhood. It was a close community and things like this just didn't happen. We know sibling abductions are rare and in the mid-70s, things like this was not seen to have happened. Families in the area stopped letting their kids go places alone, reminding them of the fate of the Lyon sisters. We had a conversation recently in our Facebook group of people who grew up in the same area that were told just that, "Be careful or you'll be taken like the Lyon sisters." No one could fathom how these innocent little girls could disappear into thin air. Jay Lyon grew up and he became a police officer. John Lyon was never the same, though. He went on to become a victim's advocate to help people like his own family. I actually found several articles on the great work he has done to support people through their grief. One that stood out to me was when, in 2000, he provided support to the father of Michelle Dorr. And Michelle was also from Montgomery County, Maryland. And she was murdered by Haddon Clark in 1986 and buried near White Oak Naval Weapon Center. And what would become a precursor for this case? She was missing for 13 years before prosecutors got a conviction without a body on Clark. But unlike this case, after his conviction, Clark did lead investigators to where they could find Michelle.
In 2013, a detective named Dave Davis was assigned to take another look at the case. Davis and a Montgomery County task force went over all the files and records in hopes that fresh eyes would uncover something that had been overlooked or even forgotten. They discovered that on the day the Washington Post article ran on the Lyon sisters mentioning the reward, which was March 29, 1975, a man had come into Wheaton Plaza Mall and told security guards that he had been there the week before and he had actually seen the girls. He said he saw a man with a tape recorder talking to the girls and then forcing them into a car. The security guard immediately contacted the police investigating the case, who polygraphed the man. He failed the polygraph. And then he told the police they made up the story about seeing the girls and they released him. No one investigating the case in March 1975 noticed this man that came forward was a young man of 18. He was white. He had long hair, acne, and scars on his left cheek. His name was Lloyd Lee Welch, and he looked exactly like the second police sketch that the artist had drawn that had gone nowhere. Now, the new set of eyes in 2013 decided to probe a little bit into this unreliable witness who had come forward, Lloyd Lee Welch. They discovered the uncanny resemblance between the sketch of the long-haired man produced by the police working with Darlene and a 1977 mugshot of Lloyd Lee Welch that was taken when Welch was arrested for a burglary. In November 1977, he had broken into a home that was about 8 blocks from Wheaton Plaza Mall, and he had stolen some jewelry. He was caught and spent about 5 months in jail.
Detectives noted that in 1975, Welch, who was originally from the Washington, D.C. area, he had traveled extensively throughout the U.S. with a carnival company he worked for as a ride operator with his girlfriend Helen Carver. After this 1977 arrest, he was arrested again in Maryland in 1981 for another home burglary, this time serving 2 years in jail. After his release, it's not clear what Welch did, although police believe that he continued to travel the country as a carny and a drifter. He stayed in homeless shelters and occasionally worked as a landscaper. But in 1992, Welch's crimes turned uglier. He was living in South Carolina at the time, and he molested a 10-year-old girl who was staying with him, who woke up to find him assaulting her. Welch was convicted in 1994, and he spent 18 months in jail. 3 years later, he molested another 10-year-old girl in Delaware, abusing her for more than a week. In 1998, he was sentenced to a 30-year prison term in Delaware and was still there when detectives, following up on the Lyon sisters' case in 2013, when they discovered his link on the case. Detectives drove up to Delaware to see Welch, and he spoke to them for 8 hours. In the course of this conversation, Welch acknowledged that he had been at Wheaton Plaza on the day the sisters went missing. When asked what he thought happened to them, he told detectives that he believed that they were, quote-unquote, abducted, raped, and burnt up. Lloyd Lee Welch was officially named a person of interest in 2014. According to court papers filed on the case, detectives interviewed Welch 11 times. He admitted to detectives that he was the man that Darlene had spoken to at the Wheaton Plaza Mall and that he'd left the mall with the girls on the day they went missing in March 1975. He said he was with his uncle Richard Welch and the cousin Thomas Welch, that they took the girls with the intention of sexually assaulting them. They brought Sheila and Kate to a home in Hyattsville, Maryland, and this home was owned by Richard and where Lloyd was staying at the time. This house had a dungeon-like concrete basement that was accessible only from an external door, and the only person with a key to this door was Richard. Lloyd told investigators that the day after the abduction, which was March 26, he saw Richard Welch sexually abusing one of the sisters on the basement floor. Court filings indicated that Lloyd told police he also saw his father and Richard dismembered at least one of the girls in the basement.
Although what you can actually believe here is debatable, Lloyd had a history of lying, and Lloyd later said he falsely accused Thomas of assisting in the crime because he was mad at him. And frankly, that's something Lloyd did. He would often name relatives saying they were complicit, only to later retract those comments. In the course of the investigation, detectives contacted some of Lloyd's relatives, including his 81-year-old stepmother, Edna Welch. She told detectives that she remembers Lloyd hearing about the reward in the Lyon sisters' case and saying that he was going to go and try to collect it. However, Lloyd later claimed that he only told the story to investigators to throw them off the scent. He said that when Edna told him she was worried that he killed the Lyons girls, he had assured her that he never could have hurt anyone like that. In letters Welch wrote to Edna from prison, he admitted to doing a lot of bad things, but also expressed hope that he would one day get out of prison. And while in there, he had gotten his GED and he completed some anti-violence courses. But his past was about to catch up with him. Investigators obtained search warrants and began searching land and houses owned by various members of the family. And Welch's relatives began to talk to the police. One of these relatives was Connie Akers. Connie was a niece of Richard and a cousin of Lloyd's. She lived at her deceased mother's home on a 34-acre parcel of land on Taylor's Mountain, which was part of the Blue Ridge Mountains in Thaxton, Virginia, which in turn is about 240 miles or 386 kilometers from Wheaton Plaza. And this land abutted a small parcel owned by Richard Welch. Connie told detectives that Lloyd Lee Welch had shown up in April 1975 carrying a duffel bag of bloody clothing, and he asked her to wash it, and she refused, and she asked him about the blood. Lloyd told Connie that the clothes were bloody because he had been carrying around ground beef in the bag, and that it had gone bad, because that's something people do. They carry beef around in a duffel bag.
And that's why you would have blood on your clothes.
Absolutely a bizarre story. Connie's brother Henry, which was another cousin of Lloyd's, was also there. Henry told detectives that Lloyd had shown up at the house with two Green Army-style duffel bags, and that they each weighed 60 or 70 pounds and had reddish-brown stains. These bags reeked of decomposition. Henry helped Lloyd throw the bags onto a fire on the property. Neighbors of the property recall seeing a fire on the Welch property that burned for several days and smelled terrible of burning flesh and death.
Because of all this information that was coming out, investigators and forensic specialists began digging on the Taylor Mountain property in September 2014. Nothing conclusive has been found, though. Prosecutors do believe that at least one of the Lyon sisters are buried at this property in Bedford, but no human remains have ever been found other than a tooth. This tooth could not be conclusively linked to the girls, though. And that's because it was lost by the Bedford County Sheriff's Office before it could be tested. All that remains of the tooth is a photograph. And unfortunately for the Lyon family, you can't DNA test a photograph. The Heightsville, Maryland home that was owned by Richard Welch was searched as well. Investigators drilled into the concrete floor of the basement, and what appears to be human blood was found. The quality, though, was not sufficient to make a DNA match to either Kate or Sheila. A multi-jurisdictional grand jury was convened in October of 2014 to weigh evidence in the case. Richard Welch was named a person of interest, and the police have indicated that he was a security guard in or near Wheaton Plaza Mall around the time of Sheila and Kate's disappearance. In December 2014, the grand jury indicted Patricia Welch, and she's the wife of Richard. They indicted her for perjury. Two other relatives of Lloyd have also been indicted for perjury and obstruction of justice. Police have cited an ongoing conspiracy by the Welch family to cover up what happened to the Lyon girls. The Welch family, on the other hand, they allege that the investigators are suffering from tunnel vision and they are obsessed with pinning the crime on the family. Eventually, though, in July 2015, the grand jury indicted Lloyd Lee Welch on two counts of first-degree murder in the course of an abduction. Prosecutors and police held a press conference announcing the indictment, and they pledged to continue the investigation and prosecute anyone else involved. John and Mary Lyon watched the press conference and then they left. They understandably wanted some privacy. It would have been a lot of information to take in, especially given what Lloyd claimed to have happened and what his relatives claimed.
The Bedford County, Virginia trial of Lloyd Lee Welch was scheduled to commence on September 12th, 2017, so only a few months ago as of this recording. Welch was charged with abducting the girls, resulting in their deaths, and burning their remains, two counts of first-degree felony murder. At the trial, it was expected that multiple witnesses, experts, and relatives would testify. Crime scene investigator David McGill was expected to testify about blood retrieved from the concrete in the basement of Richard's house, but as we said earlier, the sample was too degraded to provide positive DNA link to Kate or Sheila. Another prosecution court filing from early 2017 named 10 women who were willing to testify that they had been attacked or had been victims of attempted kidnapping by Lloyd. Two women even detailed how his interior car handles had been disabled, and they had to escape out using the car window. Darlene was to testify about her sighting of Lloyd following Kate and Sheila at the mall that day in 1975. All this evidence, plus his own statements, they had all accumulated against Lloyd, but it was still a circumstantial case. There were no bodies, even, or any forensic evidence that he was actually responsible. Regardless, the trial ended before it even began with something that has come up a lot in cases we've covered lately, a plea deal. A plea deal was put forward between Lloyd and the prosecutors, and while he pled guilty to felony murder, he did not admit to killing either girl. Felony murder holds perpetrators accountable for victims' deaths that occur in the course of their commission of a felony. In this instance, the abduction with the intent to defile was the felony, and as a result of the plea deal, Lloyd Lee Welch was sentenced to 48 years, which he will begin serving after he finishes his Delaware sentence. He also agreed to plead guilty to two unrelated child sex abuse cases in Virginia, dating back to the 1990s, that grew out of the investigation into the Lyon sisters case.
Lloyd's attorneys, who negotiated the plea deal on his behalf, shared some of their planned defense. They asserted that Lloyd had quote-unquote limited intellectual abilities, and as a result, he was easily manipulated when he was younger. And this implies that perhaps he was talked into or tricked into taking part in the kidnapping. They also maintained that while Lloyd did know that the girls were going to be sexually abused, he didn't know that they were going to be killed. It is interesting to note that Lloyd was convicted of several instances of sexual abuse of younger girls, but on those occasions, he did let the girls all go alive. It is rare for murderers to reverse escalate, however, so it isn't impossible. But it's worth mentioning that the Lyon sisters were killed when Lloyd was 18, and the other cases he was convicted for all took place thereafter. Interesting side note about this case. As we discussed before on this podcast, no body homicide cases that are successfully prosecuted, they are rare. There have only been 435 known in US history. And this particular case is the longest known duration between the actual disappearance and the nobody trial. John and Mary Lyon and Kate and Sheila's brothers, Jay and Joe, were at the plea hearing in September. And John did address the media afterward. He said, "We just want to say thank you. It's been a long time. We're tired and we just want to go home." What we still don't know is who else is involved, where the girls were killed and where their bodies are. Lloyd Lee Welsh's father died in 1998. Richard Welsh has repeatedly denied involvement and he has not been charged. Detectives spent months listening to phone taps of Richard, talking to people who knew him and probing his past, but there wasn't enough evidence to charge him. One investigator said that the case still keeps him up at night.
I think from the reading I've done, very few people out there, investigators, the reason it's keeping investigators up still, even with a conviction on the record, is that they don't think he acted alone, that this isn't over, that only partial justice was done. I think it's interesting, like you said, that he somehow de-escalated, which is incredibly rare, but also he insisted on not admitting that he was the one who actually killed either girl. Now, legally, because he was committing a felony at the time, any death that happens, he is legally responsible for, because that's what felony murder is. But I think it's interesting that he wouldn't just confess that he had killed the girls. He was holding on that he didn't. So, I mean, I think there's reason to believe that this case is only partially solved at this point.
I really don't believe that Lloyd did do this crime by himself. To get the two girls into the car, I mean, really, he would have to either forcibly grab them and quickly subdue them, but that is risking attracting attention by other shoppers. It was a busy time. As I said, like, there were a lot of people at the mall that day. For two girls, you would imagine there'd be at least two perpetrators. And the fact that there were family in the area, that Richard was working as a security guard, that he would have had other connections in the area, I just can't imagine him doing it by himself.
I think it's possible he could have lured the girls, offering them a ride home, but was a shaggy-haired 18-year-old someone who the girls would trust, whereas someone in a security guard uniform would be someone the girls would trust. I mean, I think, I'm not saying that's what happened, but I do think that, you know, there's just all these little pieces, and they point towards there being more investigation to be done in this. And whether it was Richard or the father was just some random relative, or it was the guy who earlier on we said claimed he knew who did it, perhaps he assisted. I don't think Lloyd Lee Welch did this alone.
And as something you just said then about the girls maybe trusting someone in a uniform, Mary Lyon did originally thought that someone did gain their confidence. She said that the girls were very trusting. She thought that someone could have simply offered them a ride or told them that their parents had an accident and that they had to go to the hospital. She thought that a ruse like that could have worked on them. And a story like this could explain why they got into the cars willingly. And from there, they could have been easily transported to a place away from potential witnesses. But it's amazing that the investigators haven't just given up now. Even though they have a conviction, they're not just saying, case closed, let's move on. They're sticking with it right to the end. We are on Facebook. We have the page and the group. You can like the page and come and join the group. We have some great discussions going on in the group, like our favourite episodes from last year. There was a great discussion on last week's episode on Marsha, Sylvia and Stonewall. And Charlie's brought up that there's a new Gypsy Lee Blanchard interview. I'm on Instagram at InsightPod and Charlie is on Twitter at InsightfulPod. You can email us, insightfulpod@gmail.com. If you like listening to us every week and are able to support us, we have a Patreon for an ongoing monthly donation. We have some great rewards, and Charlie has an announcement to make in regards to that.
Yes, we have a new reward for the $10 and up level. And if you did subscribe at the $10 and up level and did not get your t-shirt, please contact us. We had a issue with our supplier. And we are now switching. We have these great enamel pins that are a skull and crossbones, and they're wearing glasses, and they're great. You'll see it online. We'll send out the image. We have those. You'll also get a silicone wristband with that says Insight on it, but it also says True Crime Junkie. We have bookmarks, stickers, magnets, all the usual, but we're going to start putting our rewards into packs, and you will get a pack for your level. But the $10 level is the top one, and that will get you that enamel pin.
And links to our Patreon are on our website, insightpod.com. There you can also listen to the episodes and access some of the research that we use for each episode, so you can read up more yourself if you so wish. If you cannot do Patreon, you can still help the show. You can share this episode on your social media of choice. Tell a friend and spread the word. And if you use iTunes or your favourite podcast app allows, please rate, review and subscribe. It definitely helps bring more people to the podcast. And please listen to the end of this episode for a promo from one of our friends and one of my current favourite podcasts, Death Store.
Welcome to Death's Door Podcast, a podcast that explores some of the most haunting cases from America's death row. I'm the host, Dominique Mix, and I hope you'll join me weekly as I explore cases of the innocent and guilty, the executed and the exonerated, all of whom have one thing in common. They all know what it's like to look through the bars of a cell on death row. From the crime to the case's conclusion, I explore evidence, corruption, characters, and, of course, the crime itself. You can find the show on the Acast app, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or the podcast app of your choice. I hope you'll join in, and in the meantime, don't forget to hold your loved ones tight.